Good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for coming along today. I'm Richard Pyne, the Deputy Clerk in the Senate. I'm standing in for Rosemary Lang, the Clerk, who's on leave at the moment. Welcome to today's Senate Occasional Lecture. We meet here today during Canberra's centenary year, where people have met for thousands of years. So I acknowledge the traditional custodians of this land and pay respect to Indigenous elders past and present. Our speaker today is Dr. Aaron Martin, a lecturer in the School of Social and Political Studies at the University of Melbourne, whose research focuses on young people and politics, political participation, and citizens' agendas. Dr. Martin is also a member of the Electoral Commission's Advisory Board on Electoral Research and the Steering Committee for Vote Compass, which some of you might have used during the election campaign. It's an online survey of political opinion designed to promote democratic engagement during election campaigns. In today's lecture, Dr. Martin will discuss the extent to which young Australians are politically engaged, and we've had some young Australians imported in today to give their views later on. The extent to which young Australians are politically engaged, and he'll share some of his insights on new tools such as Vote Compass, which are designed to engage the electorate. I might add that today's lecture is being live streamed for, I think, the first time. So I'd like to give a shout out to all our friends on the internets, and particularly our friends at the NSA. So good to have you here. I'd ask you all to join me in welcoming Dr. Aaron Martin.
Okay, thanks very much for that kind introduction, and to the Senate for hosting me, and to Glenn and Gillian and Paula in particular for organising this. It's a really terrific event, I think, to be a part of, because one of the things I actually argue in my book is that, you know, there's all sorts of other forms of political engagement. I'll speak about those a little bit today. But it's really, I think, electoral politics which is the most important of those. And what actually happens, you know, through Senate and the House of Representatives is actually tremendously important, and I think we shouldn't forget that. So I'm really honoured to be here in Parliament today. So I want to talk about young people and political engagement and look at political participation in particular. And I've got various data which I'll show you, and I'll show you the extent to which young people are actually engaged or politically disengaged. And that is from a book that I wrote, which is rather inventively titled Young People and Politics, which I published last year with Routledge. I'll just present the Australian data here. In the second section of the talk, I'll then speak about Vote Compass, which I was involved with, which I think most of you will be at least vaguely familiar with, and another voter engagement tool called the Citizens' Agenda. And I think by going through those, we can think about how those tools can potentially engage people and young people in particular. So we live in a period in which political engagement is remarked upon quite frequently in the media and public discussion more generally. And the particular concern that is raised is in relation to young people. So we don't often ask, we sort of almost take it as a given, right, that young people are disengaged from politics, and we just accept that. We actually don't look at the data, right? So part of the talk, or part of the purpose of this talk, is actually to look at the data and see exactly what young people are doing and not doing. The other thing I should mention is that by political engagement and political participation, I don't only mean electoral forms of engagement like joining a political party or voting, but also non-electoral forms of engagement like signing a petition and attending a demonstration. So I think we need to distinguish between electoral forms of engagement and non-electoral forms of engagement. And I think it's useful to see the data that I'm presenting in light of this, because there's quite a vigorous debate in the literature which suggests that actually it's fine that young people aren't engaging in electoral politics because they're actually doing other things, right? So don't worry, they are engaged, but just in different ways, okay? And I think that statement is a little problematic, but at the same time, there's not this wholesale disengagement that some claim there is as well. So electoral engagement, as I said a moment ago, I think constitutes the most important form of engagement for many people. So I thought I'd actually begin there. So the first thing is attitudes towards voting. So the Australian Election Study asks the following question. Would you have voted in the election if voting had not been compulsory? And I've got the data showing to what extent this is the case here. So what we see is that 78% of young people say they would vote even if it weren't compulsory, and 88% of older people. So by young people, I mean 18 to 29. By older people, I mean 60 and over. So quite a large 10% differential there in terms of whether people would vote if it weren't compulsory to vote. We also have data from the International Social Survey Program, which is an international academic survey, that also shows that this is accompanied by quite low levels of civic duty. So in 2005, the ISSP asked, how important is it to always vote in elections? And respondents were asked to respond on a scale of 1 to 7, 1 being not at all important and 7 being very important. So here's the data from that survey. So only 42% of young people said it's important to regularly vote in elections, right, compared to 84% of older people, right? So this notion of civic duty that has propelled people to vote in, you know, previous elections is a lot weaker among young people than it is among older people. And I think this is a real concern because without that, if young people think, well, this election isn't important or I don't like the candidates, they might actually stay away from the polls. And even though we have compulsory voting, we actually see these attitudes manifest themselves in behaviour. So we know that young people are much less likely to be on the electoral roll, and we also know that they're slightly less likely to actually vote. Now, the Australian Electoral Commission is actually doing a lot of, I think, interesting work in this regard in terms of automatic enrolment, and I think they've had substantial success in getting a lot more people on the roll for this past election. But it still remains the case that young people are underrepresented, even though we have a compulsory system. We have other forms of political engagement, and party identification is another one. So whether or not people actually identify with the party. So the Australian Election Study asks about this question as well. And this figure here shows the percentage of people who don't identify with the party, right? So a list of parties, people can choose that, or they can say, actually, there's no party that I identify with. So what we see here is that 24% of young people say they don't identify with any party, right, compared to 7% of older people. So clearly, I think electoral engagement is lower among the young, okay, and I'll return to this point in a second. So what about non-electoral political participation? So I said at the beginning that, you know, there are different ways of people engaging in politics, okay? It's not just electoral politics, but there are other forms of what I call in the book non-electoral forms of participation. So let's look at the data again from the International Social Survey Program. So that survey asked various questions about, have you done this? And here it's, have you done this in the past year? Okay. So there's a few things here: signing a petition, boycotting certain products, taking part in a demonstration, participating in politics over the internet. So we see here the reverse of what we saw previously. So whereas before we saw young people being less engaged in civic duty and whether they would vote if it were compulsory, et cetera. Here we see the pattern actually reverse, with, in most cases, young people being actually more engaged than older people. Okay, so let's run through the findings. So signing a petition, okay, 47% of young people had done that in the past year compared to 35% of older people. boycotting certain products, and the caveat here was for political or ethical reasons, so not just for some other reason. 40% of young people had done that in the past year, compared to 24% of older people. So there's quite high levels of engagement actually in those types of activity. However, they're relatively easy things to do. Okay, it doesn't take a lot of time or effort to actually sign a petition or boycott a product. When we get to more labour-intensive forms of activity, like taking part in a demonstration, that requires a bit more, right? Because you have to leave your house, you have to go to the demonstration. It will probably mean that you're giving up something to do that. You might have to know people who are also going, so you don't feel like, you know, you're there alone. So only 6% of young people had done that in the past year. Okay, so much lower numbers of young people had done that. But young people are still, even though, you know, we're speaking about quite low figures, three times more likely than older people to have actually engaged in that form of activity. And then we get to participated in politics over the internet. 16% of young people had done that in the past year, compared to 6% of older people. And I have other data that I show in my book that young people are more engaged online than older people, and they're more likely to have gone to a political candidate's website or to a political website in general. So, in short, electoral politics seems to be less appealing to young people, and non-electoral politics seems to be more appealing. So I'll speak a little bit about the actual implications of those findings. So first of all, I think electoral commissions will have to work harder and harder just to maintain the current rate of youth voting, because young people are they no longer have the civic duty that characterised previous generations. And although we don't see it so much in Australia, or at least it's sort of disguised by the fact that we tend to look at voting as a percentage of those enrolled instead of voting as a percentage of those eligible to vote. If you look in other countries like the US and Canada, which were other countries included in the book that I wrote, we see quite volatile voting patterns among the young, right, that we don't see among older generations. So that's sort of consistent with the civic duty argument that older people are saying, look, it's actually a civic duty to vote. I'll vote regardless of the nature of the election. In the US in particular, you see incredibly low turnout in 2000, okay? And then you see a real spike in turnout among the young in 2008, right, when Obama first ran for president, and then again in 2012. So absent that sort of level of civic duty which propels people to go to the polls, then young people actually stay away. So electoral commissions, I think, will have to work harder to get people on the roll, to get them to regularly turn up to vote. Second of all, parties can no longer rely on habitual party supporters, okay? So we kind of know of this as sort of rusted-on voters, okay? So rusted-on Labor or Liberal voters. So the party identification figure I showed you before shows that there are far fewer of those people, and actually among the young, that's been increasing over time. So young people have actually become less likely over time to actually identify with the party. So I think parties will actually have to work harder to actually try and mobilise young people, because they can't just rely on habitual party supporters. And other research I've done with Juliet Peach at the ANU shows that voting patterns among the young are a lot more volatile. So you see a great deal of volatility over time. Because young people seem to be amenable to different types of political participation, this creates opportunities for other organisations to mobilise young people in a way that wasn't possible before. And I think the internet is more a symptom than a cause of that. And I'll speak about some sort of tools that we use to try and engage young people. So it's no longer just the electoral world, and that's all that really matters, but we've got this sort of other sort of parallel world where people are doing other things. So other organisations can actually fill in that space and in a way sort of take people away from the electoral world. The other thing, and this is a concern for me, is that the non-electoral forms of participation that I showed a moment ago tend to be done by those who are already engaged and already interested in politics. Okay, so there's resource inequalities, I think, that will be exacerbated by these new forms of non-electoral engagement. So we don't really have good data on this, but this is my hunch, right? My hunch is that the people who are participating in the non-electoral forms of engagement are also voting, right? So that means that there's another pocket of people who aren't doing anything anymore, whereas they used to at least vote or be engaged in politics. So I think that these new forms of participation have the ability to exacerbate resource inequalities, which aren't really healthy for our democracy, because we don't just want the engaged involving themselves in politics, but the disengaged as well. So to put it sort of in market terms, you might say, you know, the political marketplace is actually becoming more crowded, okay? And that creates, you know, opportunities and challenges. Okay, so I'll move now to part two of my talk, which actually looks at different voter engagement projects that I was actually involved with in the last over the course of the last election, which actually try and address some of the things that I've been speaking about, right? Because Vote Compass and Citizens Agenda were things where we're actually trying to mobilise people, improve people's level of engagement, improve their level of electoral literacy. And in talking about these, we really get to this question of, well, what does democracy actually mean in the 21st century? And I've put this word cloud up here to show that, you know, democracy can actually be understood in a number of different ways, and it's hardly agreed upon as to, you know, exactly what sort of democracy we should have. And, you know, there's been a voluminous literature written on this, and the debate really feeds into what exactly the people's role should be. Okay, so I won't go deeply into this argument, except to say that for hundreds of years we've been talking about, do we want an electorate where there's everyone's heavily engaged, okay? Or do we just actually leave it to the experts, just come in from time to time, you know, kick the bums out or vote them in again, and then go on with our lives, okay? And this is a contested area. So people like Rousseau believe that, you know, it improves, we can improve ourselves individually by being engaged in politics, and it's better to have a more participatory democracy. Whereas people like Weber and Schumpeter said, you know, I mean, you know, well, Schumpeter said democracy is ruled by the politicians, right? And all we should do is just come in and elect people in or out, regardless. So there's different notions as to how desirable it is to actually have people engaged or disengaged. And I think that's a really open question, but you could really divide the literature between the sort of leaving the people out and the bringing the people in positions. And I'll speak about that in regards to Vote Compass and the Citizens Agenda in a second. In regards to young people, we might ask, well, actually, what does politics mean to young people in the 21st century? Okay, and is the different sorts of political engagement that are being practiced by young people necessarily inferior, right? Because we always have a tendency to say, well, you know, we know best, and what young people are doing is wrong and not as good as what we used to do when we were young. Okay, and I'm not very old, so I should sort of speak about myself as a young person as well. But whenever I hear, you know, we're in deep trouble if we rely on the young, and the young are corrupted and narcissistic and all of that, I tend to take that with a grain of salt, because that allegation has been made against young people for more than 3,000 years. We've got on the written record, okay? And then before we have the written record, I bet people were sitting around the campfire saying, gee, these young people, we're really in deep trouble if we rely on them. So Plato said, you know, if we rely on the frivolous young of today, you know, the future is going to be very bleak. Okay, and that was over 2,000 years ago. So we always have to be slightly cautious in saying that, you know, young people today are so corrupted and narcissistic and all they ever do is spend time on Facebook. Okay, so I'm not saying that that claim is wrong. I'm just saying we have to be mindful that these claims have been made for a very long time. Okay, so I want to look at these questions, albeit in an indirect way, by looking at two voter engagement projects that I was involved with in the last election. So the first is the Citizens Agenda and the second is Vote Compass. The one caveat I will add is that I actually can't say an awful lot about exactly who participated in these projects and exactly what the role of young people in these projects were, because the Citizens Agenda, we're still analysing the data. Vote Compass, we haven't had the data sent to us because it was all, it's been processed centrally in Canada, and then we'll actually get the data. And I've seen a lot of the Vote Compass data, but we'll get a breakdown of exactly who participated and how long they went on the website for and all that sort of thing. So in about a year's time, I'll be able to speak about this in a bit more detail, but for now, I'll just give you a pretty broad brushstroke image of actually what we did. Okay, so let's talk about the Citizens Agenda. So the Citizens Agenda was a project that I was involved with colleagues from the University of Melbourne, from the Centre for Advancing Journalism, and it worked in this way. So we chose 10 electorates to conduct a Citizens Agenda in. So these electorates were chosen on the basis of a few different factors like internet penetration, who was the incumbent in the seat, what the ethnic or what the demographics of the seat were, whether it was a marginal seat or not. So we tried to get a wide range of different seats, okay, instead of just, you know, selecting seats where we knew that there would be high levels of engagement. And that was borne out in the analysis. So in these 10 electorates, a social media organisation called Our Say actually organised the logistics. And it worked this way. So you could go onto the Our Say or the Citizens Agenda website and you could do a few things. You had to register, but you could post a question. Okay, you could vote on a question. Each person had 7 votes, so they could vote on 7 questions only. Or you could comment on a question. So there were sort of various levels of engagement that that people could be engaged in. And then this sort of end game, so to speak, was to get people to turn up to a town hall meeting that the incumbent in that electorate and others contesting that electorate would come to. And then the question that had the highest level of votes would then be discussed by those politicians. So Bill Clinton has said that the first era of representative democracy was great, but there was a weak public mandate and inert citizenship. And he suggested that we can now move towards a second era where you have a culture of public deliberation and active citizenship. And the Citizens Agenda was really aimed at that sort of new type of democracy that President Clinton is speaking about. And I wrote an opinion piece in The Age before the election about the Citizens Agenda, and I ended that article by saying that this is a world-first trial, which it was, and we're excited to be a part of it. And then I ended the article with the question, but do citizens actually want to be a part of this conversation? I said, over to you, right? So what actually happened? The outcomes, as you may expect, were quite patchy, okay? So the success case was a seat like Melbourne, okay? In Melbourne, we had 195 questions posted on the Our Say website. We had 5,973 votes. We had 227 comments. We had a town hall meeting that was attended by in excess of 250 people. And I was actually in Chicago at the time, but I've been told that, you know, there was very vigorous discussion of the policy areas and you know, a really high level of engagement. So I think that was clearly a success. Then you compare that to something like Fowler in the west of Sydney, where we had only 8 questions, 102 votes, and no comments. And at the town hall meeting, only one candidate from the Australia United Party agreed to turn up. The event was quite poorly attended and not something I think we'd call a success. And then an even bigger failure was we had an electorate in WA where none of the political candidates actually agreed to show up. Okay, and we thought, well, you know, it's a bit like having a party where the host doesn't turn up or something like that, although actually that could be still quite a cool party. But these things aren't really going to work very well if you don't have any candidates, right? So we actually decided to cancel that event. So we're at the very early stages, as I was saying a moment ago, in terms of actually analysing, you know, who came, who was engaged, who was more, participated more on the site, et cetera. But I can say a few things, and a few things that relate more closely to the topic of this discussion, which is young people and political engagement. So the first thing is to say is that the town hall meetings were actually attended more by older people than younger people. Okay, so on the whole, we had an older crowd than a younger crowd. And I think that raises quite serious questions about what are called clicktivists, right? People who just, you know, sit in front of their computers, sign petitions, click on various things without being really engaged. So I think that raises questions about clicktivists' level of political engagement. We'll be reporting on this in a few more years, but for now, we can say that when given the opportunity to sort of engage in this more participatory form of democracy that I spoke about a moment ago, in some cases, you know, very small numbers of people actually chose to do that. There could have been a number of reasons for this. It could have been, you know, we didn't advertise it well enough, or it might have been the nature of the election. So we ran a survey before we conducted the Citizens Agenda, showing that there was very low levels of trust in government and political leadership. So maybe that affected the responses as well. But it wasn't, you know, widespread participatory democracy. Okay. Vote Compass. This was the other tool that I was involved with, and I assume that most of you here went on this website. But I'll say a little bit more about, you know, how it was designed. And if you have any more questions about exactly the mechanics of what we did, I'd be happy to answer those in question time. So Vote Compass is an interactive electoral literacy application developed by a network of political scientists, including myself and other people at Melbourne and the University of Sydney and some Canadian political scientists. And it wasn't the first country. Australia is not the first country that's actually been used in. Okay, so it was used in 4 Canadian elections in the past and a US election as well. In the last Canadian federal election, it was actually used by 2 million people and ended up being the largest data set of Canadian public opinion of public policy in the country's history. And I assume in Australia, it's also, I haven't checked, but I'm pretty sure it's also the largest collection of public opinion data that anyone has ever collected. So we got just short of 1.4 million people participate in the Vote Compass. There was probably actually a few double ups where people went on it a couple of times, although we had protocols in place to make sure people couldn't complete it many times, or, you know, it could be in any way manipulated. But at any rate, we can say, I think, that over 1 million people actually engaged in Vote Compass. So I didn't build the house, right? The Vote Compass house was actually built by some very smart Canadian political scientists at the University of Toronto. So they had a good idea of, you know, how to operate this. And then we really directed or furnished the house with Australian content. So we were heavily engaged in making sure the questions included were representative of the issues facing Australia. So the premise of the application is relatively straightforward. So based on responses to a series of public policy propositions, users are presented with an analysis of how they compare to the positions of each of the political parties. And this was driven to stimulate voter engagement, okay, but also to spread awareness about the public policy positions of the parties, increase accountability of politicians to their platforms, and prompt government to be more responsive to public opinion. The one thing I'll say is people could be as engaged or not disengaged, but they could engage in it, you know, a lot or a little. Okay, so I think the minimum level of engagement would be go on the site, you complete the 30 questions. So those 30 questions are on things like health and education, foreign affairs, etc. Then you see an outcome, right? Here's how you stand in regards to the parties. I guess that could take less than 10 minutes, okay? And then people say, that's useful for me to know, and they go on with their lives. But the application was designed for much higher levels of participation as well. So you could complete the survey. You could actually see how you can compare to the parties. You could go and look at the documents in which we calibrated the parties on different positions. You could go and look up those documents, see how the parties compare on different issues, compare yourself to the different parties, et cetera, et cetera. So, I mean, you could spend, although I don't expect that too many people did, but you could spend hours and hours and hours on the Vote Compass site. Okay, so the level of engagement could range from, you know, 10 minutes to several hours, and we'll get some data as to how much people actually engaged in that. But I'm assuming that most people, probably, you know, a vast majority of the people just went on that site for 10 minutes or so, and then they felt they had got out of it what they actually needed to. Okay, so I'll speak a little bit about the comparison between the two voter engagement tools, because they're really different sorts of voter engagement projects. So Vote Compass clearly tapped into something. Okay, so I think you could explain it in a number of different ways. Okay, so I think if you just follow the media and politics, even if you follow it quite closely, it's still quite hard to actually find out where the parties stand on particular issues. And we don't have what you have in many European countries, which is a manifesto which says, this is our party's positions, it's in one document, it doesn't change, it's very transparent. We don't have anything like that in Australia. So I think that there was a desire to actually find out where the parties stand, and I think actually Vote Compass allowed people to do that in a relatively easy way. So I think that explains some of the success. And I also think the nature of the election campaign, where some people felt there wasn't much substantive discussion of policy, that, you know, people appreciated an instrument that showed people what the different parties' policies were. The media partner obviously helped a great deal. So I think, as many of you will know, the ABC really pushed this quite hard, okay? And I think that that was responsible for a great deal of its success. Whereas with the Citizens Agenda, we advertised it on our own, and we ran it with our own money, you know, just outside of, with a relatively small project team. Vote Compass was run with a much larger project team. The Citizens Agenda is also more labour intensive, okay, because you had to do a few things. I mean, you had to at least give some thought to what sort of question you would post or what question you would vote on or how you'd comment on that. And then if you decided to go to the town hall meeting, that required a greater effort again, okay. So this is very different from the Vote Compass survey, where you just go to the site, you complete it. It doesn't, you know, ask a lot of people. And I think, you know, that's probably a good thing in a sense, because it was very user-friendly. So, you know, you didn't have to spend a lot of time figuring out how it worked. But Citizens Agenda was more labour-intensive, and we see lower levels of engagement in that, I think, as a consequence of that. The Citizens Agenda, and this is a really fundamental difference, okay, because I gave a talk at the Melbourne Law School the other day, and I'll speak E.L. Hamish, who runs OUSAE with Matthew Gordon. He was talking about, you know, what is the Citizens Agenda trying to achieve, and what's Vote Compass trying to achieve? And he was saying, well, the Vote Compass takes people's opinions, right, and then gives them something back. But there's no real interaction. Whereas he said, what we're trying to do with the Citizens Agenda that was ran through OUSAE is actually give people a sense of ownership over the issue, right, and then allow them to deliberate about that issue. Okay, so in a way, it's trying to really deepen the political engagement of people, as opposed to Vote Compass, which is relatively static. Okay, so I'll just conclude, and then you can ask any questions that you have. So the takeaway, I think, from part one on young people's political participation is that young people actually are quite disengaged in terms of electoral politics. Okay, and I think that's really concerning, because, as I said at the start of the talk, electoral politics really matters. And, you know, you can do all sorts of things outside of the electoral sphere, but if you really want to change things, you know, you're going to have to engage in the electoral world in some way, even though it's a lot harder to achieve change through electoral politics. Large-scale change, by and large, is achieved through the electoral sphere, at least in some way. So I think it's concerning that young people are less engaged in electoral politics. In terms of non-electoral participation, I think, you know, the picture is a lot brighter there, and young people are more engaged in non-electoral forms of participation. But there is the concern that I mentioned about resource inequalities actually being exacerbated. In the second section of the paper, I spoke about, you know, models of democracy and how the Citizens Agenda and Vote Compass fitted into that. In the case of the Citizens Agenda, I think you would say it has been a moderate success overall, but I don't think we were particularly effective in engaging the disengaged. Vote Compass, on the other hand, at least in some way, I think, actually engaged the disengaged, or at least informed people about their views, or it didn't inform people about their views, but informed them about how their views stood next to the political parties in a way that I don't think they would have otherwise been informed had they actually not participated in the site. So I think, to put it simply, you would say that the Citizens' Agenda constituted a deep form of engagement, right? Whereas Vote Compass, I think, constituted a more shallow form of engagement. Now, many more people completed Vote Compass than were engaged in the Citizens' Agenda, and I'll leave it to you to decide on what the actual meaning of that is. And thanks very much for having me.
We do have a microphone at either side of the room for people to come to and ask your questions. Keep your questions brief, please. And as I say, if we can use the mics at either side, it helps us when we're transcribing this later. But could I just get an indication from you, just by raising your hand, how many of you were aware of Vote Compass as a tool during the election campaign? Fantastic. And how many of you actually went online and used it? Yeah, that's great. Okay, thanks so much. I've got a question over here.
Thank you for your talk. Your figures about engagement or lack of engagement of young people are very contemporary figures. My question is essentially, is this a new phenomenon? Is there any reason to believe that young people are less engaged now than they were in the past?
Yeah.
Or alternatively,
is the inference one draws from your figures that people become more engaged as they become older?
That is an excellent question, actually, and it gets to the point that I made about have young people always been this way, and that just basically gets to the question of, is this actually generational effects or is it life cycle effects? So do people, you know, become more likely to identify with a party or to vote over time as they age? Okay. The answer on electoral politics is that this is a generational phenomenon. In other words, young people today are less electorally engaged than were young people 20 or 30 years ago. So there's something different about young people today. Okay, so there is something happening here that's quite specific to the young. On non-electoral participation, the honest answer is we don't have the data to say because we haven't asked these questions over a long period of time. Okay, so on non-electoral participation, yes, young people are more engaged. Will that continue as they age? We don't know. We'll find out. So it's an excellent question. So yes, in regards to electoral engagement, and I've actually got figures in the book which show what's happening over time, and we're not sure in terms of non-electoral participation.
Can I go with a follow-up to that?
Sure.
You said there's something specific in relation to electoral engagement. There's something different about young people today.
Yep.
Is it something different about young people or something different about politics or the political issues?
Yeah, that's another really good question as well. And I guess that there's no clear answer to that. But you could blame young people, right? It's actually young people's fault. They're lazy. Or you could say, actually, it's just the rational reaction to the political system, which they don't feel as responsive to them. So, yeah.
No, I choose to blame young people, obviously. But we'll go this side and then we'll come back over here.
Thanks. Australia's got an ageing population which is changing its demographics. Is that having an impact on the engagement with the younger population?
It could do. I haven't actually looked at that in a lot of detail. And I think there will be various challenges in terms of where we allocate resources in, because there will be an ageing population that will require certain resources to deal with. But the answer is I don't know, actually, as to whether or not that's having an effect.
I get the impression that the older population has a slightly more conservative bent to the younger population, and they're beginning to dominate the political discussion, and that might be causing younger people to become less engaged.
Yeah.
Because they feel their voice is becoming more marginalised.
Sure. So, I mean, I could say something in regards to the US and what happened in 2008 with Obama, because it's a little different system to Australia, but I still think this story is quite instructive. So when Obama was running for the presidency in the primaries in 2007, okay, the convention or the conventional wisdom was, young people do not vote in primaries and it's no use in going after them, right? It's better to actually try and mobilise the base, which is older people, right? And then Obama thought, well, I mean, there was a few different things going on, but one was, if I just try and mobilise older people, I'm not going to beat Clinton in for the nomination, and Edwards as well. And the second thing was, well, you know, Obama said, well, that's the conventional wisdom, but maybe they can actually be mobilised. He was laughed at, okay, by people on the Clinton team and others for actually deciding to go after young people, okay, because it was, well, this guy's an idiot, right? Doesn't he know that young people don't vote? He went after that group. He mobilised their support. He won the nomination. He won the presidency. Okay, so I think even though there might be this tendency to actually just try and mobilise older people, you know, there is some advantage in trying to mobilise young people as well.
Yeah, my question is about the vote compass and how it seems to me didn't have questions even about some very important issues that young people would be interested in. For example, the great increase in casual and part-time work, youth unemployment, crippling levels of HECS debt, the decline in apprenticeships in this country, and the housing affordability issue would be five issues that would resonate with young people, and I don't recall seeing them in the vote compass repertoire of questions.
Yeah.
And so was there any youth input into devising the vote compass in the first place?
It's another good question, but I just think we have to remember that Vote Compass wasn't designed for young people, and it wasn't designed, and in a way, that, you know, it's a slightly uncomfortable fit with the focus of the talk today, which is young people. We designed the tool to actually represent the issues that we thought were most important in terms of Australians generally, and we only had so much space because we didn't want to design a questionnaire that had, you know, 100 questions in it. We started off actually with about 150 questions, okay, which we got down to 30, okay. So, you know, I think it's a good point, but the tool was really designed for the general population to represent their policy interests rather than just young people's.
Yes, thank you. I only voted once in the United Kingdom before I left for various other countries. And at that time, you could not vote until you were 21. Now, because you couldn't vote until you were 21, you became more and more anxious to be able to vote. I think that was perhaps one element. A second element is that at the time I did vote in the United Kingdom, the two main political parties were very demarked one from the other. You had a Labour Party which was in favour of nationalisation, which had social security from the cradle to the grave, whereas you had a Conservative Party which went back to the policies of before the 39-45 war. Isn't this one of the problems today, that there is far less demarcation between the political main political parties?
Yeah, so there's a few really interesting points there. One is that the 21-year-old voting, and there is reasonably good evidence that that actually had a deleterious effect on turnout, because reducing the voting age from 21 to 18, the argument is you couldn't have picked a worse year to try and engage young people in their first act of voting than 18, right? Because you're finishing high school. You're trying to get a license, you're thinking about university, and just generally have other things on your mind, okay? So it's a really terrible year, actually, to try and engage young people to be enrolled to vote and then turn up. There is an argument that 16-year-old voting would be preferable because young people are less distracted by those sorts of things, and you could enrol people through the schooling system in an easier way than you could with 18-year-old voting. Things that, you know, we don't have that we want, you know, there is always this sort of, you know, the grass is always greener, or once you've actually got to a point that you've been waiting for, you might engage more. There could be some truth to that. As to whether the parties are different or not, that's an empirical question which I don't know the clear answer to. I mean, we'd have to look at different areas and the like. I mean, I actually don't know. I think it's a really interesting empirical question.
You mentioned earlier that earlier generations were more likely to be involved at a younger age. I was wondering if this was due to the very times, such as World War II, or whether it was the Depression and so on, and those older people, when they were young, got more involved and have retained their interest. Then I want to know whether or not, from that, whether you've studied the younger people who have been involved and those who haven't been involved. Has there been any criteria such as the suburb they lived in, the school they attended, their apprenticeship, their services or their profession that they're in, and so on? Are there any identifying factors? And has the involvement, my third part is, has there been any improvement in involvement by young people since candidates and parties have been on Twitter and other electronic communication systems?
The answer to a few of those questions is I don't know. Okay, I'm saying I don't know a lot, but the traditional things that you do up here is if you don't know something, then you just sort of bluff your way through things and say quite confidently, well, I think it's X, even though you don't know. So I don't actually like doing that. And I also, I think we all should say, I don't know, more often, right? So I'll say to quite a few of your questions, actually, I don't know. My book looked at young people in general, so I'm not sure about what specific groups are doing, and I didn't do sort of qualitative interviews, although I will in the future. But I wanted to pick up on what I think is the most substantial point there, which is that in the past, politics had a much more visible effect on people's lives. And I think the two events that you would pinpoint is the Depression, right, and both world wars, okay? Because in both of those cases, the state or the political system or whatever you would call it was doing a few really crucial things. It was sending you off to war. It was sending your friends off to war. You saw your friends being killed in war, okay? All as a consequence of decisions made here, right? And there's really interesting stories of, politicians, being quite almost traumatized by this decision to send people to war, because it is, and I think Obama said this in regards to Syria as well, is that it's probably the most serious decision a nation can make is to actually send young people to war. So in the past, young people were being sent to war, and there's no more salient thing than that actually happening. And then in the case of the Great Depression, you had enormous levels of unemployment, right, where people were really poor and you had huge levels of unemployment and quite horrifying stories about people's various cases. And then you had the state come in and basically, engage in programs that got tons of people into employment and away, out of, having to actually beg for food. So in that case, is politics important to your life? Of course it is. It's crucial. Now, my argument is that politics today is also really crucial and also really important, because although we can't see it, if it was taken away, we'd find out really, really quickly. Okay. So we tend to, in a way, look at how much and how much success we have in terms of politics. So young people's neglect of electoral politics is in part driven by the success of politics. But I think you're absolutely right that in times past, that connection was more visible. I think it's it's very important now to actually, even though it remains less visible, to realise actually what a tremendously, I think in large part, positive impact politics actually does have on our lives.
We've got one more question over here, and this will be our last question for the session. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Mine is not much of a question, but just an observation. With my participation with the election in Malaysia, I've had the privilege to volunteer in Malaysian election. And what I found there was that it is not so much the young or the old, but it is more the digital divide. I was volunteering in the opposition party. They've had the same party in power for 56 years in Malaysia. And what we found there was that in the areas where we could reach people via the internet, Twitter, Facebook, most of the people, young and old, would vote for the opposition for change. And the team was very much change. And yet for the areas that we can't penetrate through digital, they would vote for the government. And in that digital sort of like, because of the newspaper was completely controlled by the governing parties, the opposition couldn't penetrate to using the usual media platform. So the digital platform actually gave the opposition voice both to the young and the old. And certainly after that election, I think the opposition party thought that they would have to spread the digital, the digital voice. So it's just an observation, really, about digital. I don't know. I don't think that same issue applies in Australia. If it does, I'm interested to know.
I mean, I can just say a few things about that, not a great deal, but I do think the digital divide does, I think it does play out in Australia. And I think we saw this with the citizens' agenda in particular, okay, and some people were engaged and not engaged. And I think the internet has tremendous potential to mobilise people. My larger concern, though, is that that just becomes a substitute for more substantive engagement. So it was, I think it was Groucho Marx who said, you know, life is, you know, those who win are those who turn up, right? And I think that that can also be said, and this relates to electoral politics, you actually do sometimes actually have to turn up, right, and actually have to, you know, leave your computer screen and get engaged to affect real change. So, yes, the digital divide does exist, but I think in terms of substantial change, then that actually, a lot of it actually occurs offline.
With the experience in Malaysia, what I observed, it did actually brought the highest voter turnout. They don't have compulsory voting. Mm. And I think last election, they managed to get 82% of people coming out. Yeah. And the opposition did get the a popular vote, despite the fact that they lost the election through gerrymandering. But the digital power did get people to come out. So, I mean, that's just my observation in Malaysia. Thank you.
Sure, and maybe I'll just end by saying that, you know, I made a case before about the importance of politics, and Malaysia and other countries which aren't established democracies are interesting cases, and I was speaking to a group of Iranian dissidents a few years ago, and I said, well, where does politics happen for you? And their basic answer was it happens everywhere, right? So when we go to see a sporting game, there's politics. When we speak to our friends, it's politics. Now, part of the genius of politics in a successful democracy like Australia is that it allows politics to happen in one place and for us to get on with our lives without worrying about, you know, being coerced to do things by the government in other areas. So we can go to the football and not worry about it being a political thing. So I think that's worthwhile remembering and actually reminding ourselves, in contrast to countries like Malaysia, where you might have high levels of corruption or gerrymandering, and in contrast to countries like Iran, where, you know, politics is everywhere in a really oppressive sort of way, that, you know, we can actually get on with our lives for the most part and don't actually have to engage in politics too much, and that in part is due to the success of our political system.
I'd like to join me in thanking Dr. Aaron Martin tonight.